Good morning. May it please the court. I'd like to introduce Gary Kubek of the Debevoise & Plimpton firm, who will be arguing this morning on behalf of the appellant, MIG.
Welcome.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you again. I appreciate very much the opportunity to argue before this court. On behalf of appellant and respondent below, MIG, may it please the court. This appeal, as the papers indicate, involves an appraisal proceeding that is somewhat unusual in that it involved preferred stock rather than common stock. And although the trial court heard several days of testimony, expert testimony, on various valuation methodologies, the court did conclude correctly, as MIG had argued, and indeed as Ford Holdings and a number of cases from this court indicate, that the valuation of preferred stock needs to be based on and stems from the value of the contract rights that the preferred holders have under the certificate of designation. However, as we've explained more fully in MIG's briefs, the trial court, which did not hear oral argument on the contract interpretation issues after the hearing was over, we believe erred in interpreting the certificate in order to give the petitioners the accumulated and accrued dividends, which amounted to $29.40, those unpaid dividends, gave them a right to have those dividends under Section 8B of the Certificate of Designation, in addition to having those dividends included in determining how many shares they received upon conversion, whether it be under Section 8A, the regular conversion provision of the certificate, or under Section 5.1, which is the change of control provision, and which provides a lower conversion price and certain other procedures, and therefore ends up giving more shares to the converting shareholder upon a change of control, presumably on the notion that if they're going to have someone else running the company, perhaps they want an opportunity to get out, and if the market price of the stock is below the normal conversion price, they should be given some benefit and have a more beneficial conversion opportunity. Awarding this unpaid dividends, however, under Section 8B was inconsistent with Section 2.4 of the certificate, which actually is not mentioned at all in the trial court's opinion. Section 2.4 doesn't appear in either the original opinion or the reconsideration decision.
And did you cite and argue 2.4 to the court?
Yes, we did, Your Honor. And 2.4 provides that preferred holders are not entitled under any circumstances to receive a payment, whether in cash, property, or stock, that is, quote, in excess of full cumulative dividends. And in the case of it would be our position that by both giving dividends under either 8A or 5.1, and then again ordering them paid in cash pursuant to 8B, that's just inconsistent with Section 2.4. It is not a permissible way in which to interpret
Are you saying that Section 2.4 overrides the explicit language of the two provisions of Section 8?
No, what we're saying is that because 2.4 prevents and prohibits double payment, you then have to look at how can we interpret the other provisions of the certificate in a way that makes all of these provisions have a meaning, makes all of them work together, and gives effect to all of them, and doesn't say that one provision, for example, never applies. If I may, with respect to Section 5.1 and conversion under 5.1, the change of control option, which is the way in which the court on reconsideration ultimately came to its valuation of $47.47, there's a second reason that unpaid dividends under 8B are not available under that provision, because in fact, Section 8B itself expressly says, it begins by saying that when preferred shares are converted pursuant to this Section 8, and in order for that language to have any meaning, you can't then simply say that, well, okay, if we're also converting under 5.1, 8B is still applicable. So it's our position that, and we believe that the certificate has to be read this way, that if you in fact convert under 5.1, there can be no question about 8B because it simply is not applicable. So then turning to conversion under, and if you did that, you would get to the $18.07 per share by converting under 5.1, which is the position MIG had taken in the court below was the correct valuation. If you look, though, now, let's say they were to try to convert under instead 8A and say, well, gee, maybe 8B is also available to us. So how do you make 8A, 8B, and Section 2.4 all work together? Because, in fact, this court has said on numerous occasions in the Dorset condominium case, which we cited, and a number of other cases, that in construing a contract, you have to read all the provisions, you read the contract as a whole, and try to figure out a way in which those provisions can work together so that each of them has meaning and so that you don't, none of them become surplusage. And we submit that only Meigs' interpretation of the provisions, in fact, reconciles all of the terms of the certificate of designation. And the way it does it is as follows. If a preferred holder wants to convert under Section 8, Section 8A as a starting point would say, okay, you can take the full liquidation preference, which is $50, and any unpaid dividends, and all of those get converted at the $15 per share conversion price. But then you look down at Section 8B, and we submit that the only way you can then read 8B in a way that complies with 2.4 and thus avoids the double dip that people were referring to, and that also, though, means that you're not simply reading part of 8A out of the contract, is to say that the provision, read the provision which says that unpaid dividends, quote, shall be immediately due and payable at the company's option, means exactly what it says, that it's at the company's option. If MIG chooses to pay the dividends in cash or in common stock under 8B, it can do that instead of having them included for the shareholder under 8A. Okay, now how does that work? Well, once you've paid those dividends under 8B, there are no unpaid dividends left to be included in the 8A formula, and therefore you don't have a double payment, and the shareholder gets only the value of the dividends under 8B and the liquidation preference under 8A. But if the company doesn't exercise that and then instead allows the 8A conversion to go forward with the unpaid dividends, you put the whole number in the calculation, you figure out what the shares are. And in this case, that would only have been $9.52. So clearly, they would have been better off, and the highest value available to the preferred holders was under 5.1. Now, if you interpret 8B the way that the trial court did and the way the petitioners argue on this appeal, as always requiring payment of the unpaid dividends, if you say that the in the company's option only applies to how they pay them, then you have the problem that you're paying the full amount of unpaid dividends under 8B. In order to not violate 2.4 and to have those dividends paid twice, you can never include them under 8A. So the part of 8A that says that when you convert, you get the liquidation preference plus unpaid dividends divided by the conversion price, well, that whole portion about the unpaid dividends would never apply. And that would violate a fundamental rule of contract construction, that you don't read a contract in a way that does that if there is another permissible way. And we believe that reading 8B so that the provision at the company's option gives the company the option to decide whether to pay them out under 8B or to let them stay in the 8A formula is the one that makes sense. It also makes sense not just from reading the provisions and getting them to work together. It actually makes sense from a business standpoint, and there's an understanding of why it would be in the certificate in this way. If the stock price is very low, such as $1.80, the common stock price here, the company would not take advantage of that option because it would end up having to pay, if you convert to common stock under 8B, convert the dividends, you'd be paying a lot of dividends. You'd be paying basically at $29 of dividends at $1.80, you'd be giving them 15 shares, they'd still be getting the $29. It's a wash. But if the common stock is trading above the conversion price, and I think if you look at historical examples and the treatises, and we cited one of the treatises in our initial brief, the normal time that people convert convertible stock is when, in fact, the common stock price is above the conversion value. Here it's because there were, of course, unusual circumstances. You had a company that had been in very bad condition for many years. Stock price had declined precipitously, and therefore the price was much below, but nevertheless, because of the appraisal proceeding, it was necessary to look at this value. But if the value is, let's say the common stock was trading at $20 when someone goes to convert, and let's just, to round things off and make it a little easier, assume that instead of $29.40 of dividends, there's actually $30 of dividends. All right, if the shareholder goes forward and converts under 8A, the $30 of unpaid dividends gets converted at the $15 conversion price. They get two shares of common stock, but those shares of common stock are trading at 20, so they're actually getting $40 of value. They're getting more value than the unpaid dividends that are accrued to them, and therefore the company would certainly want to exercise the option that says, no, wait a second, let's use 8B, let's pay those dividends out. We'll either pay them in cash, which you can do under 8B, or we'll convert them at the market value, which is what the 8B provides. The market value is 20. You give the person 1.5 shares. They have $30 worth of value for those dividends, and they're actually getting what they're entitled to at most, and you're also not violating Section 2.4 because they are getting only the $30 worth of value. Now, why would you need to have that provision? Why would it talk about them being immediately due and payable? Well, you know, normally you have to declare a dividend. There has to be a record date. There has to be a payable date. This provides an opportunity if the company chooses, when someone comes in to convert, to go ahead and say, no, immediately we can pay you these dividends. The other thing it gets around, there's another provision in the certificate, and I apologize, I don't recall the section right now, which says if there are accrued dividends, unpaid dividends, you can't pay them piecemeal. You can't pay some shareholders those dividends. And so this allows the company to overcome that and to say, okay, this person who's converting out and is coming out of the company, we can pay that person, but we don't have to declare a dividend that's payable to all the preferred holders. When you look at this interpretation of the contract, we believe that all the provisions fit together, they work together, each term of the contract, of the certificate of designation, has a logical meaning, and therefore that is how, in fact, the certificate should be interpreted. And under that interpretation, the value you get is the $18.07 converting pursuant to the change of control option under 5.1, so a lower conversion price, but without the inclusion of the unpaid dividends, except in the conversion itself, which gives them some value and provides $18. Yes, that's substantially less than the $50 that this preferred was issued at 10 years earlier, but the preferred holders are still actually preferred in the sense that they're getting 36% or so of that initial amount. The common stock was bought out at $1.80. It had been trading up at $12 or $13 when the preferred was issued. The company did very poorly. The common shareholders got about 12 or 14% of the value that was left. So there's still, even if you want to look at it in kind of an equity standpoint, apart from simply the reading of the contract, it still preserves the notion that preferred holders get more than the common holders do. And we believe that the judgment should be reversed with instructions to enter a judgment based on the $18.07 per share value.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Stuart Grant on behalf of the appellee. The appellants here asked the court to just waive all common sense and ask you to hold that as a matter of law or as a matter of contract, that a preferred stock with an arrearage of $29.40 really is only worth $18.07. And they do that, I think, through sleight of hand, which I will hopefully be able to tell you. But it does remind me of a game I used to play with my little boy, showing that I had 11 fingers, where I'd start and say, look, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, plus 5, I've got 11. And that's exactly what he does here. When, in fact, the contract is really very simple. And I filed yesterday, and with the court's permission, just hand up a little chart, if I might. May I approach, Your Honor?
Other counsel, I take it, has seen it.
Yep, it was filed. I have extra copies for them. This is a very simple chart that just takes you through with pure common sense of how the certificate of designation works. You go to Section 8, and in particular 8A. And no surprise, what is Section 8 entitled? Conversion. So that tells you how you convert, and it provides the conversion formula. And in fact, it's the only section that provides a conversion formula. You can't find that formula anyplace else in the document. Now, one of the things it gives you is the denominator, and it says this is what you divide by. And there is a special situation in which that denominator changes. And for that, you go to 5.1. And 5.1 talks about change of control. And it says in a change of control situation, the denominator changes. It's not a separate conversion section. It just changes the denominator. Then the conversion section 8A says, but this is subject to 8G. Because normally you can convert into stock. But if they're doing a transaction, when that stock disappears, what you get to convert into is what the common holders got in lieu of their stock, which, again, is not a very surprising or lack of common sense. If what you can convert into is no longer there, you've got to tell someone, well, what is it that I get? And 8G says that since they did a deal at $1.80, what you get to convert into is a share, but you can't get those shares, so you get $1.80 instead. And then 8B says, by the way, once you're converting, one of the other rights you also get is your payment of all your accrued and unpaid dividends. This is not exactly a shocker. I mean, this is a standard way that documents like this are written. Here's what you get, and it takes you right through. And I suggest, Your Honor, this is exactly what the court did. And, in fact, the first, second, and third provision of this chart, my friends on the appellate side don't disagree with. They just say, wait a minute, you don't get 8B. And they say you don't get 8B because it's an either-or. They want to make it disjunctive. And they also say you don't get 8B because 2.4 says you can't do that. Well, they're simply wrong on a couple of accounts. First of all, 8A and 8B are not disjunctive. There's no or there. It says this is what you get. The second thing, if you read 2.4, just kind of tells you what a poorly drafted document this is. 2.4 says holders of shares of preferred stock shall not be entitled to any dividends, whether payable in cash, property, or stock, in excess of full cumulative dividends. Well, I looked up what cumulative dividends are. And if Your Honor does that, you will see it doesn't tell you. It tells you what accrued dividends are in the definition section 1.2. It tells you what accumulated dividends are in 1.3. But it doesn't tell you what lowercase cumulative dividends are. So I'm not even sure what that is. Then they say, well, let's assume that those are all the dividends that built up, the $29.40, which is a leap. It's not clear. It's a leap by putting their interpretation of what cumulative means. So then they say, aha, you can't double dip between A and B. But A and B actually serve completely different purposes. B says you get the dividends that you should have gotten over the last 8 years. It's just when this happens, you're going to get them now. 8A says we have to put a value on the preferred stock itself. Not the dividends, but the stock itself. And how do we do that? We have a formula. And it tells you one of the things that's in the formula happens to be the amount of accumulated dividends that are outstanding. But it's not, it's just part of the formula. So 8A tells you this is what the preferred stock is worth. 8B tells you these are the dividends that haven't been paid on it. And you get both. Because, of course, that's what a stock is. It's the future income and all that, which is one part which A deals with. And B is here's what you're owed in the past. It's a very simple.
Mr. Grant, the one provision that doesn't appear in your chart summarizing the different parts of the certificate of designation is section 2.4. How are we supposed to deal with that?
Well, as I mentioned, I'll go back, Your Honor, two ways. Number one, 2.4 is a meaningless provision because it's not defined. It's poorly drafted. It's just poorly drafted. It's not defined what in excess of full cumulative dividends means. I didn't draft it. Nick drafted it.
So is the argument that we ignore it, give it no effect?
So number one, I would say it has no effect. But number two, if Your Honor wants to give it effect and give it the effect that they say it has, they say, well, you can't get more than your, I'll say, accumulated dividends, although I don't know what it means. And I submit you're not getting that. 8B is giving you those accumulated dividends. And you get that. Then it's what do you get for the preferred stock itself. And you could get the liquidation value. You could get the market value. You could get any of those things, but they say, no, the certificate doesn't give you. The certificate gives you a formula, and the formula says how much is the liquidation value, how much is the accumulated dividends, divided by an arbitrary number, $15, which is just a number that's picked out, or alternatively, a number less than that, 7.91, if there's a change of control. So it's just the formula to get the value of the preferred stock, as distinct from AB, which is, here's the dividends. Now, they say that AB should be read to give them a choice, but the court below pointed out that if you look where the modifiers are, that makes no sense at all. The modifiers basically says that it's at your choice whether you pay them in cash or stock. It doesn't say it's your choice whether you pay the cumulative dividends or not, because let's think about it. The company always has the choice to do that. I mean, talking about giving terms, words that are unnecessary, I mean, the company can always decide we have $29.40 in accumulated dividends, we want to pay them out. They don't need the certificate of designation to say we give you permission. They always have that permission. And in fact, if they wanted to prevent this, what they call double dip, what I just say is a term that's used to value the two different parts of the security, all they had to do is immediately before the change of control was pay out the accumulated dividends, the arrearage. If they paid out the $29.40 immediately prior to the change of control, if that's what the corporate people did, they structured it that way. And why the corporate folks in Mr. Kubek's law firm didn't do it that way, I don't know. But they could have paid it out just before the change of control, then had the change of control, and then that number that would have gone in 8A would have been zero. And so you would have just had 50 divided by 7.91, and then you would have already, there would have been no arrearages, and that's what would have been paid. For whatever reason, which is not in the record below, they didn't do it that way.
Let me see if I can walk my way through what you just said. As I understand the argument suggested by the other side, first, there's some facial inconsistency or apparent facial inconsistency between 2.4 and 8B. That is, one provision says you can't recover dividends above and beyond the cumulative dividends, but 8B says that on liquidation you can. And your response is there's no facial inconsistency at all. That is, whenever, whatever, or whenever 2.4 might apply, it doesn't apply in the case of a merger. Is that correct?
Well, not that it doesn't apply, but because the word 8A and 8B is set up, it becomes irrelevant. I guess irrelevant and doesn't apply probably in effect means the same thing, but it doesn't because 8A is not another dividend payment section. It's saying here's the value of that preferred stock, and 8B says here's the value of the dividend, and it's just 8A figures out one portion of the security, 8B figures out the other portion of the security.
Well, that your second argument is just as a factual matter, this whole issue could have been avoided if the company had paid out the dividend before the change of control.
Immediately, yes.
But they didn't.
Right.
And it appears that there is some limited, or at least arguable limited double payment or overlap, which the chancellor recognized in his opinion. I think he said that it's in the application of the formula that there may be some duplication, which is equal to the value of some three shares, but
correct,
it's not a total double dip.
Correct.
And then he went on and said, if that's the case, that's a problem with the drafting of the certificate, and it's not the problem of the petitioners.
Well, it's twofold. He said that. I would agree to that, and I would say, number one, it's a drafting problem, but the other thing is it's a payment problem. In other words, had they not been in arrears, had they paid the dividends, as my client would have loved them to do all along, or when they had the ability to catch them up, had they done so, they wouldn't have this issue. So this is an issue created, one, by their own drafting, and two, by their own choice of dividend policy. And with that, I'd like to actually go back to Ford Holdings, because Ford Holdings is actually the only case which talks about the appraisal of a preferred dividend, and it's one that, of course, is in the Chancery Court, not binding upon Your Honors. So one of the first interesting issues that the court faces when you write your opinion is Ford Holdings the right structure? Neither of us have challenged whether it is or not, but it's something that the court presumably will accept, but if not, you know, we don't even get there. But Chancellor Allen says in that Section 262, the appraisal statute, represents a statutorily conferred right. It may be effectively waived in the documents creating the security only when that result is quite clearly set forth when interpreting the relevant documents under generally applicable principles of construction. So the presumption is, if you're going to waive that right, because we thought actually the right shouldn't have been waived. I mean, I lost on this issue below. I presented a whole case as to, you know, what its real value is and why it was $79. The court said, no, you're wrong on this. I'm going to go straight with the certificate of designation. But in that very same paragraph on page 973 of the opinion, 698A2, Chancellor Allen says, secondly, I note the ambiguity in these matters ought to be construed against the issuer who, as the analysis below certainly indicates, had it within its powers clearly to establish the result for which it here contends. And that's, I bring that up at this point, Justice Jacobs, because it is not only the drafting problem that causes this, you know, 2.4 and 8A and 8B situation, but it's also their choice of how they were going to pay dividends, when they were going to pay dividends, and I think Your Honor knows our contention that up until trial, when some fancy experts and lawyers got hold of it, it always appeared to be the purchaser's intention that it was going to have to pay substantially more than $18.07. And in fact, the what was sent out to the shareholders, JX Exhibit 133, the notice of the merger, says preferred shares, and then there's a lot in between, are entitled to receive from the company payment of the, quote, fair value, close quote, of their preferred shares as determined by the Delaware Court of Chancery in an appraisal proceeding. It doesn't say you're entitled to ask for $18.07 according to the certificate of designation. The last point that I'd like to make is, what about the 600,000 shares of preferred stock that did not seek appraisal? Because I think you see what happens with them makes the chart that I give you make all the more sense. Those shares actually can't convert into common stock anymore. The common stock's gone. So those shares, prior to this merger, you could convert, and depending on what the common stock price was, on any given day you could have more or less than the day before. But ever since this merger took place, there is no common stock to convert into. So what can you convert into? $1.80, that's all you get. So for the last 2 years, although this stock is out there, what is it worth? It's worth the conversion ratio times $1.80. If the company does well, it doesn't matter. If the company does poorly, except I guess if it goes into bankruptcy and liquidates, it doesn't matter. That shares are actually effectively locked in as to what they can be converted into. And that's why when the Chancellor said, effectively, you know, this is a mandatory conversion or, you know, a coercive conversion, it's because there's nothing else to convert into. A year ago, you can convert into the $1.80 a share. Today, you can convert into $1.80. A year from now, $1.80. The formula in 8A isn't going to change. What you're going to get at the end of the day isn't going to change. Effectively, they have been converted. They just haven't monetized that conversion. One day these folks will wake up and say, we're making an interest-free loan. You know, we probably ought to get our money and go. But that's what's happening to them. And unless they can tell you that somehow that's converted into something else, I don't understand how this doesn't logically follow. Unless Your Honors have any other questions, I think I'm done.
Thank you.
Your Honor, Honors. I believe I have a few minutes remaining, so I'd just like to address a couple of the points that Mr. Grant made. I would note he referred to the exhibit that was handed up as a very simple chart, and I would respectfully submit that it is much too simple, in part for the reason that Justice Jacobs raised, that it completely ignores Section 2.4. In addition, the statement that 5.1 simply gives you an alternative price that you plug into 8A is wrong for several reasons. We have explained them in the brief, but just briefly, Section 8A itself says that the $15 conversion price is subject to adjustments, and the adjustments are all in Section 8C. It doesn't refer you over to Section 5.1. Section 5.1 doesn't refer to itself as being an adjustment of the conversion price. And indeed, as we have pointed out, Section 8 uses consistently throughout conversion price as a defined capitalized term, whereas Section 5.1 simply refers several times, not just once, so it's not just a typographical error, to conversion price being a different conversion price under the change of control option. And we submit that those two reasons both submit, indicate that you can't simply plug it into there. Moreover, if that's if appellees were correct that that's what you do, you would then have them saying that all conversions under Section 5.1 are really conversions under Section 8A. Well, then the beginning provision about in Section 8B, which says when shares are converted pursuant to this Section 8, that might as well just have been left out of the document. It's in there for no reason. You're giving it no meaning. So not only are we going to ignore 2.4, we also have to ignore the introductory portion of Section 8B. We're not arguing that these are disjunctive, 8A or 8B. We're simply saying that there are circumstances in which both A and, well, in each case, 8A and 8B both come into play if you're not converting under the change of control option. But the company exercises its option to use 8B, in which case 8A doesn't disappear. It's simply you adjust the formula. Opposing counsel's suggestion that somehow you could keep them both in place because 8B is paying the dividends and 8A is valuing the stock, but you still count the dividends when you value the stock. Well, if the dividends have been paid, how can that possibly be part of the value of the stock? The further they go in trying to explain this without actually taking account of what 2.4 really says, the more convoluted and confused the explanations become. With respect to the point that that it's not clear what 2.4 means when it refers to cumulative dividends because it's not a defined term, I would respectfully refer the court to Section 2.1, which talks about, quote, such dividends shall be cumulative from the issue date and shall accrue on a day-to-day basis. I think apart from the common sense understanding that this is a preferred issue with cumulative dividends, the document itself provides that. So the notion that you can simply ignore 2.4 because cumulative dividends isn't a defined term has no value. The suggestion that that MIG could simply have decided to pay the $29.40. First, I would note that it was not us or our clients in the sense that people who now own MIG were simply in the process of buying MIG at that point. But yes, it is MIG presumably could have done that, but it had no obligation to do that. They have not appealed from the decision below, suggesting that the value all comes out of the certificate. And the certificate has provisions that deal with what happens if there are unpaid dividends, accrued and accumulated dividends at the time of conversion. So the idea that, oh my goodness, they should have just paid it off and then there'd be no problems, well, no, you have to try to figure out how the contract works in a way that all these provisions take effect. They could not have simply, for the reasons I indicated, paid the dividends just to the converting shares. They would have had to pay the dividends to everyone or to no one under the normal provisions of the dividend provisions of the certificate. And lastly, with respect to the notion that the contract is ambiguous and therefore somehow should be construed against MIG, this Court has said on numerous occasions, a contract is not ambiguous simply because someone can assert another position as to how you ought to interpret a certain language. You can't look at the language in isolation and say, gee, if I were on a desert island and I only had this one sentence in front of me, I'm not quite sure how I would interpret it. You have to look at the overall contract. You have to look at how it fits in with the other provisions, and we respectfully submit that when you do that, the interpretation that we have put forward is one and the only one that, in fact, gives meaning to all of the terms of the contract. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.